Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've got a really potent mix of sources in front of us today. It's quite the stack.
Yeah, it really is. We're looking at these urgent reports on the government shutdown's immediate impact, right alongside a really detailed fact check of a major policy announcement.
And some pretty striking examples of political maneuvering shifting communication standards. It's a lot.
So our mission here is pretty straightforward. We want to quickly give you the core facts, help you, you know, cut through all the rhetoric.
And really understand the tangible consequences from, like, global nuclear policy way up here.
Down to, well, whether your neighbor can buy groceries this weekend.
Oh.
Connecting those dots.
Okay, let's start with the most urgent thing. It's Friday, October 31st, and the sources are screaming about this deadline for SNAP benefits expiring tomorrow.
SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And yes, screaming feels about right. This is huge. We're talking about 42 million Americans potentially losing vital support overnight.
42 million.
Yeah. Children's, seniors, people with disabilities, veterans. And in Pennsylvania alone, the sources estimate about 2 million residents.
2 million just in PA. Facing losing funds for, what, milk, bread, fruits, the absolute basics.
Exactly. And the panic is already setting in. We've got comments from faith leaders on the ground.
Right, like Reverend Matthew Best in Harrisburg. He mentioned seeing a big spike in worried emails, people stopping by the church, terrified about losing these funds come Saturday.
And what's really crucial here, I think, is pushing back against the stigma. There's data from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Oh, yeah. What did that show?
It showed that 85% of families getting SNAP actually had at least one person working in the last year.
85%.
Right. So the narrative that it's, you know, people who just don't want to work, it doesn't hold water.
And for those who aren't working,
often it's health issues, disabilities, or just the crushing cost of childcare, things preventing them from working. Not a lack of desire.
Reverend Bess also made that point about how close so many of us are to this, didn't he?
He did. Said something like, most Americans are just a paycheck or two away. And the stats back it up. Only about 46% have even 3 months of emergency savings.
Wow. So one bad break, one medical bill.
And you're right there. It makes this crisis feel much closer to home for everyone, you know.
Let's stick with the human side. Councilman Ralph Rodriguez in Harrisburg shared his own story.
Yeah, about growing up using the old food stamps, the actual coupons.
He said it was the difference between a hot meal and going hungry. But he also talked about the embarrassment he felt using them as a kid.
And that connects to Elizabeth Austin's piece from Bucks County. Really powerful.
She talked about needing SNAP when her kid's father left, and then again, losing her job while her daughter had cancer.
Yeah, just an impossible situation. And she used that phrase, feeling a blanket of shame at the checkout.
It just obliterates that whole just get a job line, doesn't it?
Completely misses the mark. Ignores the messy reality of people's lives.
Okay, so that's the human cost, the urgency. Now let's look at the political side. The inaction allowing this. There's this story involving Senator John Thune.
Ah, yes, the Schadenfreude moment, as one source called it. Joy in misfortune.
So Thune's identified as one of the key people with Trump, Speaker Johnson, who could actually help resolve the shutdown, right? Stop this SNAP crisis.
Mm-hmm. Talk three with the power.
But when asked about working through the weekend to fix it, he basically said,
a waste of time. His words.
Right. Waste of time. So he finishes up in the Senate, rushes off to Reagan National Airport.
Yep. Heading home to South Dakota.
Only to find his flight delayed by 90 minutes.
And the reason for the delay... You can't make this up.
Go on.
Not enough air traffic controllers working.
Yeah.
Because of the government shutdown.
Oh, God.
The very shutdown he said wasn't worth his weekend. Grounded his own flight.
Wow. Okay. That's something. So while there's this failure to act on domestic needs, we see this huge kind of aggressive global posturing.
That's exactly. Let's shift gears to that nuclear weapons tweet. The announcement about resuming testing.
First time in over 30 years. Posted on a personal social media account. Instructing the Department of War.
Yeah, the whole thing was just riddled with errors. It's almost like a masterclass in how not to announce policy.
Okay, let's break down the fact checks from the sources. Error one, the U.S. has the most nukes.
False. Russia has more. Over 5,500. The U.S. is just over 5,000. So, wrong on count one.
Error two, claiming the weapons were all updated and renovated during his first term.
Mostly false. The big recent modernization effort. Largely kicked off under Obama.
Okay. Error three, China will be even with the U.S. in 5 years.
Highly unlikely. Projections show China hitting maybe 1,000 warheads by 2030. Still a distant third, even, just isn't accurate based on any intelligence.
Error four, the core idea resuming physical tests of warheads.
Yeah, this is a big one. First, nobody's done it in 30 years except North Korea. Second, it's unnecessary. We have advanced lab tests, simulations.
So why risk it?
Exactly. The huge risk is reigniting a global arms race.
Yeah.
Something basically everyone wants to avoid.
And error five, telling the wrong department to do it. Department of War.
Right. Well, first, that department name hasn't existed for ages. It's the Department of Defense now.
Mm.
But more fundamentally.
It's not even DOD's job.
No. The nuclear stockpile, its safety, maintenance.
Yeah.
That's the Department of Energy, specifically the National Nuclear Security Administration. It's just wrong on every level.
So the timing. An hour before meeting Xi Jinping, what were the sources saying about why? Why release something so demonstrably flawed?
Well, a few competing theories emerged from the analysis. One possibility, pure power play, art of the deal stuff, trying to look tough before the meeting, even if the deal was mostly done.
Okay.
Another thought was narrative change. There was chatter. He got the short end of the stick on the China deal that was coming out. This tweet definitely changed the headlines.
Mm-hmm. Shifted the focus.
Yeah. But the theory that seemed maybe most plausible, given the error,
was confusion.
Possibly. Russia has been testing some new nuclear-powered missiles, not warheads, a key distinction.
Mm.
Maybe that got garbled or deliberately conflated.
Or maybe even like Meiji nostalgia, that 1950s better dead than red nuclear testing vibe.
That was floated too. Regardless of the exact why, the what is striking, five major factual errors rolled into one announcement.
It suggests the facts themselves are secondary, right? The posture is the point.
Exactly. Posturing over policy, details don't matter as much as the dramatic declaration.
And that pattern, that sort of willful disregard for verifiable fact, connects directly to our next bit here.
Yeah.
Sources drawing parallels to Orwell's 1984.
Right. The whole reject the evidence of your eyes and ears command. It feels very relevant to some of the political communication we're seeing. Aggressive spin, maybe even gaslighting.
Let's look at examples. Speaker Mike Johnson on the shutdown.
Mm-hmm. He said Democrats are required to open the government.
Yeah.
Said Republicans were helpless, needed 60 votes in the Senate.
Okay, but technically you do need 60 votes to break a Senate filibuster, right? So isn't he just stating a fact?
Ah, but that's the newspeak aspect. He frames it like the 60-vote rule is some external force imposed by Democrats, making Republicans powerless.
When actually,
Republicans have options they control. They can negotiate a bill differently to get 60 votes, maybe attract some moderates. Or more drastically, they could just get rid of the filibuster rule itself for legislation.
So he's presenting a choice they could make as an obstacle someone else put there, deflecting accountability.
Precisely. It's spin that claims helplessness while ignoring their own agency.
Then there was DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. This quote was pretty direct.
Yes, stating flat out, there's no American citizens that have been arrested or detained. Anything that you would hear or report that would be different than that is simply not true and false reporting.
Wow. Just deny reality entirely. If reports contradict the official line, the reports must be false.
It's that core Orwellian thing, isn't it? Telling you to distrust what you might see or hear elsewhere. Trust only the authority.
And the last one, the Nobel Prize claim. This one was just out there.
Oh, yeah. Energy Secretary Chris Wright, and was amplified by Trump, claiming a Nobel Prize in physics for quantum computing work meant, quote, Trump 47 racks up his first Nobel Prize.
But the work was done when?
1984 and 1985. Decades ago.
Yeah.
The source just dryly notes that presidents don't get to, like, co-own Nobels won during their term.
It's claiming credit for something completely unrelated, separated by decades, just asserting a win.
Facts optional. Chronology optional.
Great. Let's use this idea of aggressive communication and look at political positioning. The New York governor's race. High stakes.
Definitely. You've got Elise Stefanik, who rose fast in GOP leadership after Liz Cheney was ousted. Now aiming for governor in a very blue state. New York is rated D plus 8.
D plus 8, meaning Democrats usually win statewide by about 8 points. Tough climb for a Republican.
Very tough. She has resources, though. $13 million banked, the Trump machine behind her, his top pollster, Tony Fabrizio.
But the history. New York's only had one Republican governor in 50 years. George Pataki, who was pretty moderate.
Right. And Trump himself hasn't done great there, polling-wise. 37% to 43% in recent elections.
So what makes this race interesting, then? The polling.
Yeah, the polling's where it gets weird. Governor Kathy Hochul, the incumbent Democrat, doesn't poll great against a generic anyone else. But against Stefanik specifically, Hochul usually leads.
Usually.
Usually.
Yeah.
But there's this one poll, an outlier from the Manhattan Institute, that actually showed Stefanik slightly ahead, 43% to 42%. Just 1 point, but still.
Okay, an outlier. But why is that specific poll so interesting?
Because that same pollster, using presumably similar methods, also produced the best poll results for Zohran Mamdani.
The Democratic Socialist who ran for NYC mayor?
Exactly. An insurgent from the far left. Which leads to this fascinating theory in the source material.
Which is?
The potential existence of a Mamdani Stefanik voter.
Wait, what? How does that work?
The idea is maybe there's a segment of voters who just want to shake things up.
Mm-hmm.
They crave disruption, insurgency,
mm-hmm.
whether it comes from the far left like Mamdani or the far right like Stefanik. It's about breaking the status quo more than ideology.
Huh. So attacking Mamdani's ideology might not be the slam dunk Stefanik hopes for if some voters are drawn to both kinds of insurgency.
Potentially, yeah. It's an intriguing wrinkle anyway. It makes the race less straightforward.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time on conflict, spin, bad news, basically. Let's shift for the end. There's this concept mentioned, Freudenfreude.
Yeah, the opposite of Schadenfreude. Finding joy in other people's joy. A nice counterpoint to all the antagonism.
And the example comes from Pope Leo and Catholicos Patriarch Wa III.
Right. Two major global Christian leaders. And you have to remember the history here. Tiny differences in doctrine between their predecessors' churches led to centuries of, well, actual violent conflict. Wars were fought over this stuff.
Okay, serious historical baggage.
Huge baggage. But in their meeting, Owe III apparently made a joke at Pope Leo's expense about being a Chicago White Sox fan.
Just a gentle ribbing.
Exactly. A lighthearted personal jab amidst this moment of, you know, significant ecumenical progress.
So what's the insight there?
It's that despite disagreeing on really fundamental historical points of doctrine things, people literally killed each other over. They both understand they're fundamentally on, let's say, Team Jesus.
Focused on a bigger picture.
Right. Shared goals.
Mm-hmm.
Making the world better, more humane. They showed you can disagree, even profoundly, without being disagreeable.
Yeah.
And that humor, that shared humanity, is vital.
Okay, so wrapping this all up for you, the listener, we've gone from the devastating immediate impact of the SNP cuts hitting families this weekend, all the way to global nuclear posturing based on, frankly, falsehoods and this really aggressive political spin designed to override reality.
And then this contrast, right, between the political sphere where facts seem optional and spin is king, and this example from the religious sphere. Leaders with centuries of conflict behind them, finding common ground, shared mission, even sharing a joke.
The stakes feel incredibly high everywhere right now. Political failures have real, painful consequences, as we see with SNP. Reconciling deep divisions seems almost impossible sometimes.
So the final thought we want to leave you with is this. If Pope Leo and Patriarch Alito III, with all that history, can find a way to focus on shared goals, value good humor, and disagree without hostility.
What lesson can we take from that? In this age of polarization and just information chaos, how vital is finding that common ground, that touch of humor and humanity, even when the disagreements, whether they're political or doctrinal, feel monumentally important? Something to think about.